Welcome, listeners, to the Cozy Corner with Alexia Gordon, the podcast that highlights cozy and traditional mysteries. You won't find stories filled with explicit sex or graphic violence. You will find interviews with authors who create crime fiction filled with intriguing plots, engaging characters, and high-quality writing. Thanks for listening. Welcome, listeners, to another episode of the Cozy Corner with Alexia Gordon. I'm Alexia Gordon, author and host of the podcast. Jacqueline Winspear, author of the Maisie Dobbs novels, joins me in the corner today to chat about The Consequences of Fear, the 16th in the series. Welcome, Jacqueline.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. It's lovely to be here.
Now, you write a long-running series featuring one of the most popular protagonists since Miss Marple. Now, your fans know all about Maisie, of course, but for listeners just discovering this series, would you tell us a bit about Maisie and what she's up to in The Consequences of Fear?
Okay. To introduce Maisie, readers first met her in the first book in the series, Maisie Dobbs. And that opens in 1929, but that story has a lot of her backstory woven into it. And in fact, she comes from very lowly beginnings, but she's a very, very bright young woman. And her intellectual ability, if you will, is noticed by a friend of her employer, an interesting man called Dr. Maurice Blanche. And he sort of takes her under his wing and really, I suppose, introduces her to a world and people that she might not have known, but very much from an educational point of view, because she still has her job, still has her day job. She wins a place to a prestigious ladies' college in Cambridge, Girton College, and she gives up that place at the opening of the Great War, and she becomes a nurse. She lies about her age, which is what a lot of people did. She lied about her age to serve. But we meet her, as I said, in 1929. It's after the war. She is stepping out on her own as a psychologist and investigator, having been Maurice Blanche's apprentice for some years. And of course, the first case unfolds and we find out a lot about Maisie's life. But through the series, and as you say, this is book number 16, and we're now in 1941. So Maisie is a lot older, and each of the books has taken us further on in time. So it's you know, there is not only an arc to each story, but there's an arc to the life of each of the characters. Because there's not only Maisie Dobbs, there's her assistant Billy Beale, and we come to know his family, we come to know her family, and her friends, and those that she associates with. And everyone has their story. So that sort of brings us up to October 1941.
Now, as you mentioned, the first novel was set in 1929, which is a decade before England declared war on Germany.
Yes.
The Consequences of Fear, as you said, brings us to October of 41, which is just a couple of months before the attack on Pearl Harbor that brings the U.S. into the war. So back in 2003, when you were writing that first book set in 1929, did you realize you were going to cover such a long span of time?
I didn't even realize I was going to cover another book. I was writing a story that was in my head. And that's what I was thinking of. Boom, that story. And I was very immersed in it at the time. And, you know, you'll know about this. I had the day job. And I was also getting over a really bad accident at the time. Be that as it may, one of the things that was happening is I was writing. Whenever there was a scene that I thought, oh, you know, that doesn't quite fit. Or a piece of dialogue or something. If it didn't fit, I put it in a file on my computer desktop marked fragments. We Winspears are pack rats. We don't throw anything away because it might come in useful one day. And it was after, you know, I mean, I was very fortunate. I found an agent when I'd finished the book, and in time there was a publisher, and we went through all that process. And on the day the book went into production, my editor called me and said, oh, Jackie, let's talk about the next book in the series. And I thought, what, you know, the next book in the series. I did a little tap dance, and I actually pretended that someone was at the door or something like that, because I thought, oh my gosh, I don't know what to say. But what I did was I thought, okay, I've got my fragments file. Let's get that out. And I printed off every page, which was often only a paragraph. And I put it out on the floor and I moved things around. And I thought, okay, I've got the kindling, not the story, just the kindling for more books here. And I figured I had probably another 5 or 6 books, but I had to, but just a spark, just a spark. And that gave me an opportunity to sit down and think, okay, what do I want to write? If I'm writing a series, what do I want to write? And I wasn't clear that I would come this far, because of course one, you know, if you're selling, you've just sold, you know, you're just publishing your first novel, you don't know if there's going to be a 2, 3, or 4. And I realized that what I wanted was to have a character who would grow and change and move through time. And so there's not just, as I said, that arc to the story, but there is an arc to the series, because that to me felt like a very organic way of moving forward. And of course, I love history. I love, absolutely love women's history. It's been a subject I have been really curious about since I was a kid. So it gave me an opportunity to really, to indulge myself completely in the history of the time. So that's how I figured it out. Thank you. That's a good question. Thank you. So I had a chance to figure it out, you know, what, how am I going to do this? And so far it's worked.
Very, very well. It's been working for 16 books and counting. But speaking of, I mean, you didn't just pick any period in history. You picked a period there where so many significant events have occurred. I mean, you span the trauma of a nation that's you know, struggling to deal with the loss of an entire generation of men in the First World War, to the post-war social upheaval that contributed to the rise of the Nazis, to the trauma of another modern world war so soon on the heels of a war that was supposed to have ended war forever. So how do you balance the weight of that history with the demands of telling, you know, a good fictional story?
By remembering it's all about the story. And this is something I guess I alighted on earlier on. And it, in a way, it just came naturally, because, how can I put it? I, particularly in the earlier books, I was doing an awful lot of research. And I still do a lot of research, but I've also got a lot of research already done, so to speak. I've done the foundations. I've got the foundations. And, you know, as I was doing that, I mean, it was that realization. And I don't think, to be quite honest, Alexa, it wasn't something I thought consciously, but rather a feeling. I'm not writing narrative nonfiction. I'm writing a story about people. And, you know, okay, they're fictional people, but they are people, and it's about character. And what I would have always been interested in, yes, there's all the events of the era, all the events of the time, but how do all those things affect people? And the only way to tell that, to tell the truth, is through fiction. And so that was my focus. And what I did, I just trusted that all that work I would done would find its way into every word I wrote. I didn't need to say, and they walked along the street and that building was, you know, put up in 1871 and da 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 da. You know, I didn't have to get it all in just because I'd done it. And I came to realize that in a way, all that knowledge and understanding I'd garnered was really like an iceberg. Only 7% of it should be visible above the surface. I guess what it comes down to is the fact that when you're with fiction, you can touch universal truths, and you know, the facts are like the seasoning that underpin those truths. I don't know if that makes sense.
It makes sense. Yeah. It also leads into my next question. You know, this is also a period that is rather well documented. And I'm only exaggerating a little when I say there have been a gazillion documentaries and books and scholarly articles, plus the, you know, this is an era where we have contemporary, you think, you know, we've got photographs, we've got the recorded
absolutely
radio interviews, and you can listen to Churchill actually speaking, or Roosevelt actually speaking. Mm-hmm. So do you even worry about either teaching someone something they didn't know about a period that they probably at least think they know a lot about? Or is it, hey, I'm, you know, my first responsibility is to telling the best story I can tell. And if they happen to learn something about history, that's kind of a bonus, you know, icing on the cake. But, you know, the story is the story of Maisie and her friends and family, or what's the main concern?
It's the story. It has to be the story. And it's developing authentic characters and the story that sort of holds water, that is believable. If people then become curious about their own family history, about a period of history that they didn't know anything about, and they suddenly think, oh, you know, well, that could explain why great Uncle Jack didn't talk to anybody for the rest of his life or whatever. And then they delve into it. That is icing on the cake, actually. And I have, right from the get-go, received all sorts of emails and messages from people who, in reading the books, it's taken them to another sort of place. I've actually heard from a lot of veterans, and interesting enough, from people who work with veterans' families, you know, to try and help them get over that period of coming home from a war zone or whatever. And I found that actually very curious, because, or I was curious about that because I asked someone about it, and she said, well, she said, I don't want to insult the spouses group by suggesting self-help books. She said, but we can get into fiction together that takes us to the conversation. So in a way, it's allied to your question. So the answer is that you know, yes, the focus is my story, because I'm a storyteller. I'm you know, I'm a storyteller. I like to tell my stories. I like to get into character. I like to weave in the events of the day, because I like to know how ordinary people are affected by the big things that happen. And that can all become part of the story. But if then someone reads it and goes off and does that family research, they look into something they have never known about before, or it helps them understand something about their own family experience or whatever, then, as I say, that's good to know. It's an icing on the cake.
Yeah. And speaking of family history, I think I read that some of your family history has found its way into Maisie's story.
You know, without doubt, you know, because if I look, and what it is, it goes back to that kindling. It's the inspiration. So I can look at events like my grandfather was severely wounded at the Battle of the Somme in 1916. He was shell-shocked, gassed, and he had horrible wounds to his legs. He was still removing shards of shrapnel from his legs when he died at the age of 77. And I was 10 years old at the time, you know, so I had seen that happening. And I knew about his, you know, the fact that he was very sensitive to sound, which actually a lot of men in from that war, and actually even today, have percussion injuries, i.e. the fear the sound gives of distant artillery fire gives them the fear of what will happen next, or they're literally physically affected by the sound. My maternal grandmother was wounded in an explosion in a munitions factory in the Great War. Her brother came home from the war wounded and died not long afterwards. And she didn't want to get married in white because she said, I can't, because I'm in mourning.
Wow.
And then you go into the Second World War, and, you know, I come from a big extended family, and there's a lot of us about. And so, you know, I look and almost every theater of the Second World War was, one of my family was there, you know, whether it was North Africa, Sicily, you know, the beaches of Dunkirk, and so on and so forth. And it's not that you hear big family stories, you just hear the little snippets, and it just takes one little snippet for the imagination to work with that. One of the things in the consequences of fear, my father, he was about 13 when war was declared, but even before that, because he was a very, very, very fast runner, and he had been literally picked from the boys in his school, only a couple of them, the air raid precautions people came around to run messages during the bombing. So after school, he would, at 12 years of age, 13, he would report to an ARP depot, get his tin hat, and he would have to run messages.
Wow.
And goodness knows what he saw. So, and not only that, there's the civilian stories that have worked their way into my books, you know. There's, and I don't want to give too much away for readers, but who haven't got that far, but there's the appearance of Anna, the little evacuee. Well, my mom and her siblings were all evacuated out of London at the beginning of the war. And so that sort of takes you further on. And you know, there's often things that people have seen, people have witnessed, and which can give the writer, particularly I think of mystery, something to go on. You know, something to go on. Elegy for Eddie, for example. My book Elegy for Eddie was the character is based upon someone that my father knew when he was a boy. And, you know, it's amazing how even before I became a writer, you know, I would hear a story and I'd actually think to myself, oh, there's a story there. You know, I that's fabric I can work with. But, and I guess I just filed it away, Alexia, just filed it away for a later date.
How has your family or your extended family reacted to little bits of their stories working their way into your series? Are they happy? They think that's the coolest thing in the world, and they tell all their friends, hey, that's actually, you know, that's grandpa, or they,
yeah.
You know, like you said, you know, sometimes, you know, maybe Uncle Jack doesn't want to talk to anybody about what
he's
doing, so he might not be so happy with it. So how?
I'm very careful. It's just a little bit here and there. Although I will add that when I wrote The Care and Management of Lies, which was my standalone novel, not actually a mystery, but set firmly in the Great War, and it was about the relationship between the military and food, and also a relationship between two women. My mother got into it a couple of chapters. My mum passed away a few years ago, but she called me and she said, well, I'm reading your new book. And I said, oh, yeah. And she said, well, she said, I've got to tell you, you can't say anything around you without it ending up in a book. She said, you really have to keep your mouth shut around you, otherwise it'll end up in a book. And I guess, you know, I mean, The American Agent, my book, The American Agent, it starts off with... And it's a lot of it is about reporting in the Second World War, and it starts off with it opens a scene with an American journalist in London, and there is something she witnesses, which is very heartrending, and it's something one of my aunts witnessed, and that aunt is now 92, and almost every time I see her, she tells me again, because she was a very impressionable age when she witnessed this event after a bombing, and it's never left her. So, you know, she was maybe 15, 16 at the time. And, so I guess my family have, they care for what they say around me now.
Now, you mentioned that, you know, the character who witnessed this event based on what your aunt saw was a journalist. So it's, you know, it's a woman with a profession. Yes. And Maisie herself has a profession, and she's a actual private detective as well as a psychologist. And this is a period where we tend not to think of women as having certain professions. You know, if it's, especially in detective fiction, you know, it's fine for the woman to be the amateur sleuth in books set during this period. But so did you find during your research, you know, women working as professional investigators, and how did you research their backgrounds?
This is something that I've been, I guess, really interested in. It's even when I was a teenager. Actually, the first woman detective at Scotland Yard was a woman called Dorothy Peto, and she, and that was in 1929. But here's the thing, and this happened more so in the UK and Europe than it did in the US at the time. So I guess it's not surprising there is this idea of women and their position. But one of the things that happened in the Great War was that, before the war started, you could expect your life to be pretty much like your mothers and grandmothers before you. Your opportunities were probably as restricted as your clothing. And then we move into the First World War, and literally, if it was male and it was over a certain age, it was going to go to war. You know, men were drafted in the hundreds of, in the millions, actually. And initially, it was thought there was no place for women, but it soon became evident that the war could not be fought without the work of women. So in Britain, women moved into war work and other work as never before. And that didn't quite happen in this country, in the United States. But to give you an example, I think there were probably, and someone will correct me on the stats, but 2 or 3 million women already in work in Britain. And just like here, they were doing invisible jobs. They were taking in laundry. They were looking after other people's children. There were some women already working in that newfangled thing called an office, and, you know, with those things called typewriters. And yes, there were women, some women had professions. But suddenly, you know, the Great War opened up this big sort of avenue of opportunity, and some 900,000 worked in, almost a million worked in munitions. Women went into almost every field of endeavor to release men for the battlefield. The first women went on the streets of London as auxiliary police officers. They buried the dead, they built houses, they built bridges, they worked in aircraft construction. They went to war as ambulance drivers and nurses, and also as agents. Women were code breakers even in the First World War. And some more than 50,000 women worked for the then fledgling Secret Service. And it was really built on the back of their hard work. The youngest were actually girl guides who were running messages. They tried the Boy Scouts, but they skylarked around too much and didn't, the messages didn't get to where they were going. And so there was this great sort of, I mean, the work of, and everything was even advertising was geared towards getting women out. You know, it was sort of like, there's a hot drink called Ovaltine, and it was set your daughters on the way to work in the right way. And it was a hot drink. And of course, after the war, it was, you know, don't, whatever you do, don't give her Ovaltine, you know. But the thing is that for so many women, Alexia, it changed their notion of what was possible, because they were suddenly in looser clothing, shorter skirts, because, you know, that long skirt is going to get, you're going to be up to your knees in blood by after an hour if you're a nurse in the battlefield in a long skirt. It's got to come up. And ditto with, for example, working in munitions. You had to, your clothing had to be different. Women were wearing trousers in some jobs, and so on and so forth. And I still remember, it was part of my research earlier on, I was at the Imperial War Museum in London in their archive, listening to old sort of audio recordings. And these recordings went back to probably, I want to say the 1970s, when it was realized that generation, probably the 60s, that generation was getting older and passing on. So they had to get the audio recollections of the generation that had lived through the Great War. And there was this one woman, I was listening to her, and I think she had probably just been asked the question, how did the war change your life? How, the Great War change your life? And she, and you could suddenly, you imagined her sitting ramrod straight in her chair saying, well, my dear, let me tell you, the war opened the stable door. When that stable door opened, we women bolted. And once we had bolted, there was no going back. And there's actually a wonderful book called Singled Out by a woman called Virginia. Oh, gosh, her last name will come to me in a minute. Virginia. Anyway, it'll come to me in a minute. And anyway, Singled Out. And it was a book that I would love to have written. Terrific research. But it was about that generation of women and how, even after the Great War, so this is Maisie Dobbs' generation of women, they blazed a trail and they moved into public life as never before. Many became teachers. There's a, you know, there's a job that brings you into contact with children. And for so many, there wasn't a husband and kids. And think about it. It was the great age of the woman mystery writer. There's a job you can do at home with no training, as I always say, as I know only too well. You know, it's think of the women, you know, there's so many, and that they, to me, that indeed so many characters, great women characters, came out of that generation as well. The very doughty British woman who could take on the world and indeed solve every crime because she's better than the men.
And that actually leads into, I mean, I literally did have a question about the Queens of Crime written next. So
Yeah. Yeah.
so it's you know, I'm thank you for bringing that up because I wasn't going to ask you about that. But and sort of on a side, I also remember hearing on the podcast, I think She Done It. There was an episode about surplus women who I think also came
Yes.
out of this period. Or you
Yeah.
mentioned the women who didn't have the husband and because that literally the marriageable men were all dead. And so is did that class of women, for lack of a better phrase for them, figure into your into the main?
Oh, absolutely. There's one thing I wanted to do with the book. It was to honor the spirit of that generation of women. Because indeed, the 1921 census revealed that there were 2 million, quote unquote, surplus women for whom there would never be a husband and children. And in fact, questions were asked about who would control these crazy women who did not have the calming hand of a man upon them. I mean, really. And what When I was a kid, I knew those women, you see, because they were the ladies of a certain age in our very small rural community who were miss this, miss that, miss the other, you know, and all really getting on. And for every single one of them, you went into their house and there was a sepia photograph of a young man lost to war. Usually, you can imagine the photograph in his uniform with, you know, the potted plants and the curtain behind, you know, staged. And they all, you know, a lot of had those sort of photographs done. And what I remember are women that were incredibly sort of doughty, very strong, opinionated women who were sort of stalwarts of a community, never interfered as such, but were always sort of there. And I just really wanted to honor that generation because I started getting very interested in that history as a teen. It comes as no surprise that I ended up writing about someone who reflected that generation. I wanted to very much in the books, and also this is to do with many of the people that Maisie meets, to show the broad spread of experience. And I didn't sit down and think, how am I going to do this? It sort of came organically. So there's the, you know, there were women who absolutely, as I said, blazed a trail, but there were those who also floundered, you know, they maybe looked after their aging parents to the end of their days, and then they ended up in a little bedsit type flat, a little studio, or living with another woman. And you know, no one asked questions in those days and said, well, you know, what kind of relationship is that? Because there was a real sense of honoring the companionship, and everybody needs companionship. And you know, for many women, that was another woman who had also lost her sweetheart. And people growing old together. You know, I knew people like that when I was a kid, you know, and it was the misses, the miss this and the miss that. So in Maisie Dobbs, you know, sometimes people say, well, you know, some pretty horrible things have happened to her. Pretty horrible things happened to a lot of people then, you know, really horrible. And you know, there were men and women who had lost children in the early years of the century, and to any one of those diseases, scarlet fever, diphtheria, you know, tuberculosis, smallpox, whatever. And then only to see their children go off to war in the Second World War. So, you know, people experienced awful things. And so, but I wanted to, I guess, give a sense, and particularly with that generation of women, of the resilience, their capacity for endurance, but not to take away from the I emotional and financial challenges that many of them faced. So yeah, that'll make you write a mystery. You know, you can just imagine now sitting there thinking, now what do I do? And having a great idea, you know, in your bedsit for a book or whatever. And yes, it yeah, those the Queens of Crime.
And speaking of that, and that's usually for listeners who might not be familiar with who that refers to, it's usually Agatha Christie, Dorothy L. Sayers, Nyo Marsh, and
Yes.
Marjorie Allingham, I think, are usually the ones
They're
who are.
the queen bees.
And they basically would have been Maisie Dobbs's contemporaries. And
Yes.
a lot of the strong, I think capable is the word. I think capable is a compliment, even though I think some people, I'd love to be called capable. But they also feature, like you said, the other side, the women who maybe weren't as successful. And for me, I'm a huge fan of Golden Age detective fiction. And it is the strong, you say the dowdy women. I mean, they're what draws me to it. I like strong, independent, trailblazing women. But what do you think makes it so popular? I mean, the British Library Crime Classic series, I think, is up to almost 100 books from this period that they've reissued now. So obviously people are reading them. So something set basically about 100 years ago now is still appealing to people today. So what do you think makes this time period appealing?
I think there are several things at play. And number one, they're good stories. They have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And as human beings, we have always been drawn to the journey, the archetypal journey that is the mystery. It's that journey through chaos to resolution, and all is well. Now, here we are living in a world where all does not exactly seem well at the moment. A lot of things are going wrong. We have, well, particularly now, we've had the pandemic. There's things happening geopolitically that are very scary. There's things happening socially that are alarming. And people have this, people are uneasy. We're on uneasy ground. That's how it feels. We're on, and also, for a good many years, we as a people, we have, and obviously there are whole groups for whom, this is a broad brush stroke, and there are whole groups for whom this does not work. But we have not had to live with some of the risks that our previous generations had to live with, except now with, I guess, the pandemic, which is why it's come as such a shock. And but we've not lived through a major world war, too. In a very short time, major pandemics that people suffered, or epidemics in the earlier part of the century. So there's this business of being feeling unsettled, and here we have a literary form that for a while we can go to the dangerous place, but we come out again, and all is well. And it also gives us a sense that you can go, and this is why I think especially the historical mystery, or the mystery that has been written, at that time but is contemporary, that people were living through terrible things, but they all came out the other side, and we can too. So I think all those things mixed together with good storytelling at a time when, over the last few years, for various reasons, particularly since 2016, there was a lot of dark dystopian types of storytelling out there, and both fiction and non-fiction, very dark, very dystopian, very often set in the future when it seemed that everything bad was going to happen. And people can we don't need that. A lot of people just don't need that. They want to know that all will be well, all is well that ends well. And also, there's the other thing, not to forget that, we're actually also in the entertainment industry, and people want to be entertained. People what we both know that some of the best writing, touching upon everything from environmental matters, political situations, social ills, etc., you can be found within the literary form that we call the mystery. It's almost lost my thread there, but it also has to be entertaining because people are having to put up with a lot now. And the Golden Age was very entertaining and gave all people all sorts of confidence along the way. That's my, in my humble opinion. I could be completely wrong.
So if someone asked you, someone told you that they love Maisie Dobbs and they would love to read some crime fiction written in the era that Maisie is inhabiting, where would you suggest they start?
Oh my gosh. With the classics that you've mentioned, actually. Why not? But, you know, there are others. And you see, the thing is that once you touch the tip of that iceberg, it opens up just a whole, you know, cavern of places to go with the different writers. But I think you could do no better. You know, Marjorie Allingham, wonderful. Also going to, I mean, the first ever mystery I read was Josephine Tay, The Franchise Affair. Yes. I can't remember how old I was. And I think later on, I think the next one that I actually remember was Wilkie Collins, The Moonstone, I think it was. And so so I think, yes, you've mentioned it. It's those classics. Go to those classics. But also, let's remember that these were a very special generation of women, very special. The first generation of women to go to war in modern times or go into war work in modern times in very, very, very significant numbers. And what I always remember is someone like my grandmother, my maternal grandmother, who went through that war, lost a brother, was wounded herself, and then come sort of 1939, 1940, 1941, she watched three of her children go into the service. One of my uncles who was at the Normandy landings, and another aunt was in the Women's Royal Air Force, and another aunt was in the Women's Royal Naval Service. And then I look at my dad's father, you know, seeing his sons go into the army. What did he think? And what did he think about his boy running through the streets of London, running messages in when bombs are falling? So I think of that generation and you know, no wonder we call them the greatest generations, really. But they certainly, those queens of mystery, that's a place to go.
on the switching gears a little bit, sticking with the greatest generation, I mean, you decided to take time from writing fiction, which still has a lot of, you know, your family story in it, to actually write your family story in a memoir. This time next year, we'll be laughing. So what inspired you to write the nonfiction version of the truth?
I think what it has in what the memoir has is it has those sparks in it. We don't murder people in my family. We might feel like it at times, but we've not generally come across things like that. But you know, little stories that were became sparks for me for my fiction, and that's all they are really. But what inspired me to do it? I've always loved memoir, and I think I use a lot of the, if you will, techniques that you might use as a memoirist, which of course fiction writers use, but I was so much more aware of it sort of writing the personal essay. And I had written quite a number of personal essays before I embarked upon the memoir. And in a way, the memoir is a collection of essays. It can be seen that way. But, and that is the sort of techniques of, you know, bringing the camera in, zooming in on a certain scene and sort of having a sense of when to draw back and look at the big picture. So really what inspired me to write the memoir, initially it was my parents' early years as a married couple, which were a little bit extraordinary, a little bit different. But it also, you know, when I think of the reasons why they left London and lived this rather bohemian life for a while, you know, it was to do with, particularly for my mum, getting over, or finding a way away from bomb sites and war, and some of the things that I think really played on her mind. So, but also it's a memoir about family and about, you know, the ups and downs of family, particularly, you know, quite a different time, although it doesn't seem, although to me, even now, it doesn't seem that long ago, you know. And also very much, I think of a couple of things. It's what people endure and then come out the other side. But the interesting thing is, and this is sort of associated with your question, one of the ahas I had, and I don't know, and it's probably so obvious to everybody who reads it, but it wasn't to me, is how much I was impacted by my mother's job that she did when I was about 15. And it was the job she had for the rest of her career, working her way up. She went into prisons administration. Now that was not a disciplinary role. She was not a prison officer or anything. She worked purely in administration, and initially with at a detention center for young offenders, 16 to 21. And if they're in an institution, that it's not a first offense, that they've done something bad
No.
second or third time, because first offense, unless they killed someone, would have been probation. And I still remember, and she worked her way up very quickly, and she had she accepted the job at a later date when she was somewhat close to retirement. Well, no, I think about maybe 10 years from retirement now, I come to think of it. If she had accepted the offer, she would have been the first ever woman chief administrator of a British high security prison.
Wow.
But I remember one day, and I think this really is something that shows up in my work, is her coming home from work, and I was just home from school. I guess I was about 16, and I made her a cup of tea, and we sat at the kitchen table, and she seemed a bit down. And I said, what's up? What's going on? And it was just something that happened at work, as these things are. And it was someone, some kid that had come back again. He's in trouble, and it was just a very sad situation. And she would never have named names, but she gave me a sort of an overview of what had happened to this kid. And I said to her, I said, what makes what happens to people that they end up going down, what they end up go, things end up going wrong? And she said, you know what, Jackie? She said, somewhere along the line, someone didn't care enough. And she said it might have been the parents, it could have been the grandparents and their treatment of the parents, it could have been the whatever. She said something happened somewhere and someone didn't care enough to see or do anything about what was happening. And I think that's one of the reasons why I certainly always tend to look for the victim inside the perpetrator of the crime. And vice versa, that is there something in the victim, and that's a very inflammatory thing to say at this point. But what causes where are the points of contact? Yes, where is the point of contact between a victim and the perpetrator of a crime, and what happened? What went wrong, and where did innocence leave? And and so I guess what I'm saying is it's not so much the what's in the victim, but what was that point of connection? And which I think can be, you can wrap up in a story. And I always like to see from that point of view. Yeah. So that was one thing that came up writing the memoir. I suddenly realized, oh, maybe her job did have something to do with what I do today. crime was on the table every day. Yeah.
And as you mentioned before, fiction is a way of getting at the truth as much as memoir is. In both your nonfiction and fiction, you do examine things as, where's the point of contact between the victim and the victimizer. So, but which is trickier? Which one is, well, neither one of them is easy, so I don't want to say easier, but which one is a trickier way to handle the truth, or to get at the truth, or to uncover the truth.
I think, this is where I think fiction, being a writer of fiction, it's both a challenge and a responsibility, because you are dealing with universal truths, and that's what a lot. Yes, we love the entertainment, but it's interesting how many times people come away from a work of fiction and something has resonated somewhere with them. It's because you almost can't help to touch universal truths, but I think. And what I try to do, and sometimes it happens quite organically, and sometimes I have to really, but it's all part of getting into the whole character that you've developed is what went wrong for this person that they have committed a crime or that things have gone wrong in their life? Because, you know, I don't just want some, you know, one-dimensional killer, you know, oh yeah, he did it and he did 10 of them, you know. Well, what makes someone go out and take the lives of 10 people, you know, or two people or one person? What makes someone do that? It's a question we're all asking, I think, a lot of at the moment. And what, and you can't explore it all the way because, of course, you have to keep up pace, you have to keep up rhythm, and you have to keep the reader's attention. But I think it's worth exploring because it makes it a much richer experience and much more believable if we can have some idea of what has gone wrong in someone's life that they would commit a crime. And what is it in the detective, in the investigator, that makes them see that? And in seeing that, know that that is the person that they need to be looking at long and hard. And, you know, it's interesting. I mean, just lately we've seen some horrible killings here in America, gun deaths. And it always, one of the things, and I saw today, one of the first questions is that police are not yet sure of the motive. You know, and there are probably some people out there thinking, we don't care the motive. Look what this guy did. But they have to, what is the motive? What went wrong? And I think if we're, it's part of exploring character, you know. And what was it in that victim that sparked something in that person? Was it just that they were there at the wrong time? Was it something they reminded someone of? What? And sometimes it's just being in the wrong place at the wrong time. You know, and sometimes it isn't. Sometimes there's a closer connection, and it's you know, I the last thing you want to do is comment on current cases. But I mean, one thing that I find interesting and tragic is when someone sees, you know, the perpetrator of a crime sees a connection with the victim that just doesn't exist. And then rejection causes their actions, you know. And it's you know, someone else, you know, is perhaps being kind, and it's seen as something else. I mean, it's all a tragedy, isn't it? Really, but it's how we and as writers, and I know I'm probably going off a tangent here, and then I'll be quiet. But it's I think we have to cradle that gently. We have to cradle it gently because we're writing a book. It has to be all sorts of things for the reader. But, you know, we have to cradle those, the reasons very gently.
Yeah. You skillfully take these tragedies and cradle them and give your readers hope that, you know, things will come out right on the other side. So where can we expect Ms. Dobbs to be helping people process some of those violent things next? I mean, do you envision her story carrying on into the Cold War period, or what's amazing?
I don't believe it's going to go into the Cold War period. it's hard to say at this stage. What I am working on at the moment is a book set in roughly the same time of year, but it's 1942. And suffice it to say, one of the big things that happened in the fall of autumn of 1942 is the First Lady of the United States made a visit to Britain. And the journey itself had to be quite hush-hush because of the security issues around her. Because, you know, there were, so that was interesting to me. That's all I'm going to say about that. So, but anyway, it's various things coming together. And so it's a year on, and it's a year on in the life of, you know, Maisie Dobbs and the other characters. And here's the only other thing I will say is that it's always been interesting to me how, you know, I generally am working with an idea that I had, you know, 5 years ago, but it wasn't the right time for that idea. I mean, for example, when I wrote, what is it, The Mapping of Love and Death, I've got it somewhere behind me. I had the idea for that book and was inspired by something I'd read in a newspaper, I think about 4 years before I wrote the book.
Oh.
It's just something I squirreled away. I can remember reading another author, and I'm trying to remember who it was, Anne Tyler. She was talking about her latest book at the time. And she said, I first had the idea while I was working in my garden 5 years ago. She said, but I've got two kids and I knew I couldn't write that book yet. And so it's the same. Now, all I will say is that it's been extraordinary to me how an idea that I had sort of 4 or 5 years ago and I'm working on suddenly includes, let's say, issues that are very, very current. And I don't know whether that's just that things come around again, but, you know, it almost has made me at times think I better not go near this. It's too much of a hot potato. And then I think, you know what, I had the idea years ago, so I'm just going to get on with it. It might be gone by the time the book's published. But that was certainly true of, you know, the consequences of fear. I mean, you know, in the last year, a lot of people have been in a situation where fear has been a big part of their lives.
That's so true. Yeah. As you said, there are a lot of universal truths out there. So,
yeah. I think a lot of writers would say absolutely the same thing, that they're working on something and an idea they had a couple of years ago, or a book they've been writing for several years and working on, and suddenly everything they bring up is current. It's a current issue, you know.
And so what else are you working on, if you can tell us? I mean, any more memoir or non-Maisie novels?
Actually, funny you should say that, she said. There's a non-fiction book that I would very much like to write that I have been slowly but surely doing the research for. And it's not a memoir, but it will include some reflections. I'm not going to say any more about that. Someone once told me years ago, you should never talk about what you're writing about because it takes away the need to write. So it means that you're telling the story rather than writing the story. And also I'm just sort of gathering my research materials for a standalone novel that I'm going to be working on after the book that I'm writing at the moment, which is a Maisie Dobbs book, which will come out this time next year. Sort of March next year. Yeah.
So plenty for your fans to look forward to.
It keeps me out of mischief.
Yeah. And where can readers buy The Consequences of Fear or another of the Maisie novels or your memoir that This Time Next Year We'll Be Laughing? Where can readers get a copy?
Okay. I would always point readers towards their, you know, local independent bookstores. Bookstores have done, so many of them worked so hard during the last year, bringing virtual events to readers so they don't miss out on book tours. So, and also delivering books and things like that. And they work so hard. They deserve our business. And, but all the usual, let us say online resources for ordering. If you go to my website, which is basically www.jacquelinewinspear.com, and hit the events page, you will see that there are the virtual events that I've done are all still accessible by clicking on links. And any one of those bookstores currently has my books, and they possibly still have signed copies because I actually signed books and they were sent out. So, and also that stands for the memoir as well. So it's jacquelinewinspear.com/events. But go to the website, and also the website, if you go to the newsletters page, my newsletters are usually filled with your background on the historical research that I do, and that can also be interesting and gives you more information on what I write and how I write.
So the best places for readers to connect are your website and your newsletter.
Absolutely.
All right, well, thank you so much for joining me in the corner today, Jacqueline. I know I've taken up a lot of your time. I'm taking away from your walking time, so I appreciate you chatting with me. And thank you, listeners, for tuning in to another episode of The Cozy Corner with Alexia Gordon. My guest today was Jacqueline Winspear, the author of the Maisie Dobbs novels. The latest is The Consequences of Fear. I'm Alexia Gordon, your host. Until next time, goodbye.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, listeners, for tuning in to another episode of The Cozy Corner with Alexia Gordon. If you enjoyed the show, please leave a 5-star rating or review. Help me keep bringing you fun and informative chats with authors of cozy and traditional mysteries by supporting the podcast on Patreon at www.patreon.com/authoralexiagordon. Until next time, goodbye. Thank you.